took us a number of years. What we did was the denomination now is open to all the Métis, the non-legal Aboriginal people that are of Dene descent. We have at the community level chief and councils that again originally were set up primarily for legal or treaty Indians. We've opened the membership to everyone again of Dene descent, whether they're Métis or non-legal Aboriginal people. We've set up regional councils that take into themselves a number of small communities that average size about 500 people for political lobby and to share information, to gain some political strength in face of other large non-native communities that for a number of years have dominated the government of the Northwest Territories. One of the difficulties that we are faced with, and I think this is probably all over the world, goes by the term of turning into neo-colonialists. That is, you know, after your people take over a government or an institution, it's only a matter of time before your own people start doing the same thing to you. And it's remarkable because it's alive and well in the Northwest Territories, with people that are very good friends of mine that I worked with for a number of years, took the opportunity, and in fact we encouraged as well our people to run for these positions. And these people that even as short as a year ago were saying, this is not our government, this is an interim government, are now what you would call ministers. And they're saying, well, you know, on the second thought, we're not doing too bad as a government. And flattering themselves. And, you know, it's a concern for us because I think people forget that, you know, they're not going to be around as ministers for all eternity, even though they may want to. But that the system that's in place there is, that's the problem. And it's a concern that I have, I think a number of us have, because it doesn't seem to take very long before it happens that people start to be taken in by the system. One of the mechanisms that or processes that we have to make changes as well is through the land claims process. And here, what we're using it for is to a specific example of how we're going to use this to change the system of government is to negotiate an agreement on the management of wildlife and renewable resources. And this is, again, something I hope we sign in the next couple of weeks. But basically what it does is it sets up a management board with 50% Aboriginal people in place on it. So it's sort of like a para-political negotiation. And that this management board is going to fit into the structure of government that we will hopefully complete negotiations on over the next few years. So the claims process fits very well into this whole process, and we're hoping to make a number of other agreements that would have protection by legislation and by the fact that the Canadian Constitution as well recognizes Aboriginal rights, even though they say they don't know what it is. One of the things that the new government of Canada, the federal government, has undertaken is to review what you call the claims policy. That is, they're reviewing those things that they think are negotiable through the claims process. And I mention this because it's important to recognize that the extinguishment policy that I guess went through the United States and as well Southern Canada is making its last stop in Northern Canada, because they've extinguished everybody else, and they're just the Inuit and the Métis and the Dene to go. And we're hoping to make a last stand, so to speak. And there's a number of scenarios being developed by people in Canada that object to this whole policy. And for us, what the government wants to do is to say, well, we don't know what your rights are, so why don't we just make it very simple for all of us and just say, let's agree to extinguish all of them, whatever they are. And then in exchange, we will give you back some rights. We'll give you back land rights, rights to some compensation, hunting rights, trapping rights. And that's basically the policy. And
Native leaders in this state, AFN's not going to say, come out and issue a directive and say, well, this is how all the Alaska Natives feel about tribal membership, and this is how they're going to define it. By the very fact that somebody back in 1971 agreed to a corporate system for determining membership in some organization, the corporations, they cut it off then. And I'm sure we've all heard the objections by many people of the fact that the tribal entity, again, whatever it is, I don't know what it is, the tribal entity and the tribal members are not being taken care of. For me, I think it's a simple matter of pointing out those things that causes a lot of problems. If in fact you go into the arena of the corporate structure of the Alaska Federation of Natives, anyone who thinks differently or even brings up the fact of United Tribes of Alaska is deemed undesirable in many ways, not in so many words. They might use words like radicals or dissidents, which simply labels other Natives not being able to participate in that process that was set up 14 years ago. How this commission deals with that is of interest to me, and I presume of interest to many people in Alaska, both Native and non-Native. How that position will be forwarded to either the U.S. Congress or to the Canadian government is of interest to me. But I suspect that when our congressional delegation in the state of Alaska and the governor, whoever he is 2 years from now, will not come to Tony Vasca in Bethel, Alaska to define what that entity should be and how it should work. They will go to what they recognize as a legitimate spokespiece, mouthpiece for the Native community, and that's AFN. The importance of a different perspective on Alaska Natives does come from United Tribes of Alaska. And from my perspective, again, I'm willing to wait it out to see the kinks worked out so that it at least has a legitimacy from the base with which it says it represents. And that's the people in the and those are the people in the villages. Those are that group of people is far more important to me as an individual than our members who are living in urban areas who say they represent those people in the villages. And those are the corporations, and by and large, all the corporations are here in Anchorage, or in the case of Doyon, in Fairbanks, or Sea Alaska and Juneau. They're not in Hoonah, they're not in Teller, they're not in Ruby, they're not in Guigilgo. They're in places where corporations will survive as corporations. And it seems to me that the rights given to corporations shadow pretty close to the rights given to individuals. And we have a lot of problems to work out. And what's going to happen, for instance, in a tribal community that defines its own members when one of the tribal members breaks the code of the tribe? Is he banned from the tribe forever? I don't know the answer to that, but it seems to me that that individual...
He's sent to another village.
Carry on.
It seems to me that that individual has lost his tribal membership, and that's not how, by and large, United States citizens are treated under their constitution. The other thing that we need to identify that I haven't heard anything about is how do Alaska Natives handle the presumable role of dual membership? Dual membership, one, as a citizen of the United States and the state of Alaska, two, as a tribal member. And how does that dual membership intertwine in everyday functions of either a tribal government or a state government or an entity under the federal government's auspices? There's obviously a lot of criticisms about a tribal entity because it's considered to be a closed system, where the system in the state of, under the state of Alaska or federal government is deemed to be open to all citizens equally. Those are questions that are not answered clearly. I've heard some varying answers from a number of individuals as to how that should be dealt with, but by and large, I haven't heard any response to that criticism that I'm comfortable with. And I haven't heard a real comfortable response from someone who is absolutely convinced that his or her system is how it should work. But again, I'm willing to say, well, let's grow with it and see what happens to it. I'm starting to ramble.
Well, Tony, thanks for those thoughtful remarks. Maybe I could make a few observations of my own in light of what Sheldon and Tony have said. This commission is unique in that it isn't sponsored, and everywhere I've gone in the state, every village, every town, I have made it clear that I do not represent the government of the United States or the state of Alaska, that this is an undertaking sponsored by two international Native peoples organizations. And I may say that at the outset, I was skeptical of this whole undertaking, but I found as
articulated by such people as Guy Martin and others who were involved in the enactment or in Congress, that there was an objective for economic, at least economic assimilation, if we are at the point where we're going to have to vote on it now. And it also seems that we have progressed to a point, I don't know if it's progressed or what, but we are now openly talking about conflicts and differences of opinion in the Native community, because in 1971 we were at least in a unified position of going for a land claim settlement. Now we are talking about corporate Natives versus traditional Natives or tribal people, indigenous people, and tribal governments. Anyway, we are going to be at that point where we have to educate again Native people about exactly, you know, what are the effects of the things that you're going to be voting on. If you are going to be voting on accepting new Natives, what does that, what are the implications for the survival of the tribe if you do not vote to amend the law to allow for new Natives? And clearly we already see that we have differences of opinion in the Native community, even though at an emotional level people are saying we want to take care of the new Natives. But when you look at the surveys, and granted that the surveys are not universal, but maybe only taking in 20% of a population, we still see a significant number of people saying, no, we don't want new natives because it's going to decrease the kinds of money or stock that I have. And so we are at a point now where we have to start educating Native people about what they have to do to survive just with this corporate ANGSA entity, and let alone, you know, talk about, you know, what are the things that we need to define, to identify, to define ourselves as Native people, the kind of things that what Raina was talking about. But now we also have to educate non-Native people about what it is that we want. And I just want to share this with you. I have the responsibility at this particular point in time to be evaluating the proposed curriculum for the state of Alaska, curriculum guide. And I was supposed to evaluate it for cultural sensitivity, sensitivity to Native people. I have engaged different Native people around the state to evaluate the different curriculum, the different subjects. And as we had anticipated, the one area of the most difficulty was going to be social science, although I have to say that even in areas as basic as science, computers, and mathematics, we still had problems with cultural sensitivity. But social science turns out to be really the greatest problem of them all. One of the people I engaged to evaluate it, it starts off, identify the major obstacles for the American westward expansion. And of course, Native people, Indian people. So, I mean, the tasks of education are multiple. And but I'm not even too sure if that is the sole answer or the answer. Now I just you know, like to at least summarize what I have heard Native people saying, or what we've been discussing here in this roundtable and in previous roundtables, and that is the question that we're all grappling with is, and that is, how are Indigenous people going to survive culturally? And then now we're hearing, how are we going to survive with some measure of political autonomy? And clearly, Indigenous people are expressing this all over the world. If we can take, if we can accept what we have heard from the various participants at this meeting and previous meetings. Well, it seems that if this is going to be a reality, or is something that we're going to move towards, then some of the things we're going to have to do are look at the laws that currently affect Indigenous people. And it seems that we're going to have to be altering many of those laws if, in fact, Native people are going to be allowed to perpetuate their societies, which in most instances translates to land. Land. How are we going to protect Native people's land? Okay, how are Native people going to do that? How are they going to amend laws? How are they going to affect changes? Clearly, they lack the numerical numbers, and they lack the economic powers to change laws. We don't have the pipeline today to act as a leverage in amending ANGSA. And so it seems that we must begin to develop strategies to utilize other means, and it's means to persuade non-Native people to support the claims that Sheldon has talked about, the right to cultural survival, the right to political autonomy. And so where are we again? We're back to ideologies, ethics, and morality. We're back to Lacasa's debates. And I mean, maybe we've made some progress. I don't know. But those, I guess, are the tasks, some of the issues again. And again, I'm still left with questions.
Well, I think in the nature of things, we're bound to be left with questions. Might I just suggest that we proceed in the following way? Dessa, you wanted to say something, and I said earlier I would set, arrange that, and maybe you could go next. And David, you wanted to say something. All right, David, and then Dessa, and then Paul Goodwin, you wanted to say a few words. And then I'd like to come to Gard and Moani, if that's all right, and Verna. And we've still got a little bit of time. If you don't mind, let's just stop for 5 minutes for a cup of coffee. Do you mind that? Half a dozen people who would like to add something. David and Robert Goodwin and Dessa and Gard and Verna and Paul Goodwin. So, David, you start off then.
I just had a couple of Oren ask a question as to whether the Claims Act had done any.
Of this, and perhaps this is not terribly new to a lot of people, but I knew that eventually this whole round table would try to look to education for some of the answers, and I don't think they're terribly they're all attainable. And I've been trying to, I guess, illustrate here how within the 21st century, you know, we can have a meaningful kind of education, and there isn't the time to deal with the more specific areas which we are really trying to begin to deal with. And we have done a lot of work in curriculum ourselves, based on our languages and all kinds of work, because it's difficult to have to change a system and move back, you know, into the kind of learning that is meaningful today. So anyway, I'm sure that Mr. Berger didn't intend me to talk so long, but I did make a few notes yesterday on that item when you were asking.
Well, thanks very much, Verna. I think we all appreciate your description of some very real successes that have occurred in where we come from in Canada, and for which Verna, I should say, is in many ways largely responsible. That won't come as any surprise to you, having heard her. Gard, and then Dessa, and then Robert Goldwin, and then me.
I share your enthusiasm, Verna, and appreciate your presentation that you've just made. I too wonder what kind of results would have happened if some body chemistry tests were given to our ancestors after devising such intricate ways of recording the environment that they lived in so well. I think it was, I get a little bit annoyed at left brain, right brain kind of stories, because I think they sometimes tend to stereotype cultures in ways that are they're skewed. They have absolutely no relation to what really happened. At least that's my own point of view. I happen to be the culture education chair for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and also serve on the President's Advisory Board of the Kamehameha Schools. Yesterday I talked about the last princess of the Kamehameha dynasty, who left all of her estate to the revenues to support a school for Hawaiian children. That was done almost 100 years ago. And I wanted to talk briefly on the schools, go into a little bit of OHA, and then And I think we have a little bit of different attitude. There's a little twist that's maybe a little bit different, maybe not. It depends how you look at it. And then as you were all talking, I was thinking back, and the last queen, Liliuokalani, and Kalakaua, the last king, were very interested in education. The Native Hawaiians, of course, started the public schools. I talked about the fact that when the missionaries developed the language, the Hawaiian nation became literate almost in a year's time, the entire nation. Such was the new learning was such, they met it with such eagerness and they became literate. School that I want to talk about, however, I wanted to say too, the king and the queen used to pick children of high potential, and they would send them away for an education. They deliberately sent them to Italy, to France, to England, because they wanted to groom leaders, and they wanted them to be world citizens. They wanted them to know they wanted them to be of the world and yet know their own culture well. The queen herself spoke 3 foreign languages. She composed music. She translated the ancient chants. She was steeped in the hula and the oli. So she and the king, and he was the first king to whatever it means for a small and feeble nation, to go around the world, made a trip around the world to see how the rest of the world lived. And he had a very global kind of understanding and wanted his subjects to have that kind of understanding also. Besides, and it was the king who, despite the missionaries' objections, restored the hula, the chants, and all the ancient learning too. He did it despite the great missionary objections to pagan learning and to anti-Christian or whatever they called it at that time. At the Kamehameha schools, there are 3 divisions that comprise the educational program. There is a campus program for about 2,000 students, with about a third of that student body who are boarders. They live on campus. And that division has strengthened its program to where they expect from the sophomore years the students are to take the scholastic aptitude tests. They are given all the cultural courses and the cultural languages and the orientations, as well as they are given computer instruction.
I have a hard road to find. I can't run more like this. It has to be more like this. So I have to. the case, I'm a Jesuit priest. I like your use of that word survival, because I think a lot of our education.
Okay.
I just don't get around. It seems to me there's a lot to be developed out of the value of survival. That an education system could be developed. In fact, I'd only use the word education. A training system which the survival skills for the bush, for the tundra, are taught, the survival skills for the city. So far as a person has to go to the city, they need certain skills to survive.
Yeah.
And they don't have to move from the city.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I've been in the city, I was telling Sharon, I've been here too long, for 10 years, and I only came to get an education. Just
a little business.
Time to go back
home. Yeah, thank you. No, there aren't any tribal mills. What happened was they could get a better price on ground log export to the mill. They could not agree politically because each town could have its own political trade-off. Some in Alabama, too. Some of those Chickasaws may have the Choctaws, but those would be very recent. I don't think the Seminoles ever did any logging.
Bingo players will be hopping in here about 4:30. Did you see when we left last night?
Oh, yeah.